Over the last 10 years of my life, I have been beaten by dog meat traders, charged with espionage, and jailed more times than I can count now by my own government, in all for rescuing animals from abuse. And the story of why this all happened is, first of all, just kind of engaging and hilarious and awesome and scary at times, but also really important for everyone to hear because there's an atrocity unfolding in the shadows behind closed doors all over the world. It's an atrocity against animals. And in many ways, my life's journey is a story of that atrocity, but not just the story of the violence that happens to animals, but story about what we can do about it and why we need you. And I mean, literally you need to be involved. And that's why we started this YouTube channel, to tell these stories of rescue, of transformation, and to help people like you find your place in that movement. So for those of you who don't know me, my name's Wayne Shung. I'm an attorney, a former law professor, a convicted felon, and a longtime animal rescuer. And I'm standing here today, or I should say sitting here today, after recently coming out of jail for organizing a demonstration in which 500 people occupied a massive factory farm that supplied to Whole Foods, marketed itself as certified humane, but in fact was torturing animals and confining them in spaces so tightly that at my trial, the owner of the company himself conceded that animals are eating each other alive. I guess there are two things to say about the place that I find myself in today. First of all, what the hell is going on when even in certified humane Whole Foods egg farms, you have animals literally cannibalizing each other and the government's doing nothing about it? But second, what is going on with this movement of people rising up to take direct action to aid these animals? And to really understand both of those questions, what's going on with these animals and what are people doing about it? I think it's important to look at personal stories because the way we look at the world depends on the way we look at individuals. And my story is one story that illustrates the broader problem of animal abuse. So I was born in this country in 1981, shortly after my parents moved here from China. And we didn't have any animals in our lives. We really didn't even have any human beings because I grew up in a community in central Indiana where I think I looked back at the statistics recently, and I think it was less than 2% of the entire population of Hamilton County, Indiana, was non-white, and we were one of them. And I didn't have a lot of fun with the rest of the kids because, you know, they didn't like outsiders that much, and I still have a lot of fond memories of Indiana, but school was definitely not one of them. But there was one kid in my neighborhood who always loved me, and he loved me so much that every time I'd see him, he'd literally jump up and down in happiness. And the kid was a dog. It's my neighbor's dog. And I still remember every day getting out of the school bus, oftentimes after getting bullied, pushed around, being in tears, running home and feeling like everything in the world was against me. Everyone was out to get me except for this one dog. And that one dog taught me immensely about the powerful relationship we can have with animals if we treat them well. So shortly after some of these experiences with my neighbor's dog, my parents were kind enough to allow me to adopt my own dog. And my first dog when I was growing up was a mutt that we found in the classified ads named Vivian. And it's funny because my parents chose this particular puppy out of a litter of six or so dogs because she was the most timid, the most calm. She thought, this dog's going to be easy to handle. This dog was wild. This dog was running all over the neighborhood, smashing down our doors, chewing through everything, and I had so much fun with her because every day I'd come home and instead of having to beg and plead and hope that my neighbors would let me play with their dog, I could play with my own dog. And that's what we did every day. And I'd come home and she'd jump into my lap and lick the tears off my face if I was crying. We'd laugh and roughhouse on the ground, roll around. And she was my best friend almost instantly when I got her. But then I had a really dark experience. Actually, two dark experiences. The first was Vivian developed a very serious injury. First, she started limping around and her back legs didn't seem to be working properly. And eventually, she just couldn't walk at all. And we took her to a bunch of vets and they said, she's going to have to die. And we were just weeks away from a trip to China. In fact, my family's first trip back to China in 40 years because my extended family had been banned from China after a civil war in 1949. And around 1989, we made these huge plans after people from Taiwan were finally allowed to go back to China to take our entire family back to go see these long lost relatives we hadn't seen in so long, to see our ancestral homeland. And so this is a huge trip we had planned for years. And it was a scary trip because the Chinese government wasn't so nice to Americans, and certainly not Americans who were born in Taiwan and whose family was part of the Taiwanese military, which my extended family had been part of the Taiwanese military. So we had all these huge plans that we'd been building up for years for, and then my dog gets sick and can't walk, and we're not sure exactly what's going on. And every vet tells us, you're just gonna have to kill her. But before we put the needle in her and ended her life, I made one last plea to my family. I said, and my sister was involved in this too, I got down on the ground, I was in like a bowing posture, and I was crying profusely, and I told my mom and my dad, please, just give her a chance to get back on her feet. Please, just let's go to China. I didn't even want to go to China. I wanted to stay home with her. My parents were going to allow that. But let her stay with my aunt and my uncle, who had moved to Indiana with us. Let her try and recover, and let's see what she's like when she gets back. So we go off to China. I'm already terrified about what's going to happen to my dog. But almost, I think within a few days of arriving in China, I have the second horrible experience. It wasn't just my dog being sick and falling to the ground, being unable to walk. But I go to this restaurant in southern China. I think it was near a city called Guilin. And in China, most people, especially in the more rural areas of the country, like their meat fresh. They don't want to buy packaged and processed meat. And, you know, people in the United States like their food fresh too. But in China, they slaughter the animals right where you're buying them to eat. And in this case, we went to a restaurant that I think it's loosely translated as a wild earth restaurant where you can get all the flora and fauna of the planet Earth. And many of you have probably heard the term wet market from COVID-19. This is basically a wet market where they slaughter the animals on site and serve them up for you to eat at a restaurant. And there are all sorts of wild animals there. I mean, just it was mind-blowing to see all these animals. It almost felt like a zoo. All these animals, I didn't even know what kind of animal they were, like pangolins, weird raccoon-like creatures, monkeys. And I remember my dad and I both seeing a monkey in a cage. And my dad, who was not someone who was very fond of animals, who experimented on animals, he actually tested on animals in his lab in Indiana because he was a biomedical researcher, seeing a monkey with like a collar around her neck, just cowering in the back of the cage and saying, this is cruel. This is cruel and I don't like this. But the thing that immediately captured my attention and left just this searing hole in my heart from that day, and honestly for the rest of my life, was first hearing and then seeing dogs in cages being prepared for slaughter. So in China, dog meat is probably about as common as lamb in the United States, but there's a lot of people in China, you know, 1.3 billion people. And even if there are a relatively small number of those people who eat a particular species, there's going to be a lot of dogs being killed. And at that time, there were probably a few million dogs being killed for meat every year. And I saw for the first time in my life one of them. And there was a particular dog, like a black mutt, who looked exactly like my dog at home, Vivian. And I saw her cowering and looking at me, and I saw, most importantly, that she was scared and she wanted help. So I collapsed on the ground. I remember just grabbing my dad by his legs and his knees, because I was, you know, like 8 or 9 years old at the time. And I just started crying and begging and screaming to my dad, Dad, we gotta help. I mean, that dog is just like Vivian, and someone's gonna eat her. And I remember until the day I die, the words my dad responded with, which were, D, that's son in Chinese, there's nothing that can be done. This is just what they're taught. There's nothing that can be done. This is just what they're taught. And it was the first time in my life that it occurred to me that some of the things we're taught are wrong. And I grew up a very rule-following, law-abiding kid. I never thought of myself as a rabble-rouser, certainly not an activist, certainly not someone who would ever break the law or even break the rules in school. And yet here I'm being told that the things that people are taught in China don't just allow, but promote and encourage horrific violence against the dog I love as much as anyone in my family. And I revolt against that idea. And I think there's a lot of other people who, when they're exposed to the realities of the dog meat trade or other abusive animals in factory farms and laboratories and fur farms, reach that realization as well, that there's something that we're taught that is wrong. There's something that's being hidden from us, that when we recognize it, we recognize something dark about the world that needs to change. And that was the first moment for me that I realized there's something profoundly broken in our relationship with non-human animals. Because I don't care how many people tried to argue that it was okay to kill dogs. I don't care how many authority figures told me that it was legal and totally within the rights of these dog meat traders to beat and kill dogs to death. I knew it was wrong. So there's some disagreement between my dad and myself as to whether I actually saw or even heard these dogs being beaten to death. But what I do remember is, for sure, for the rest of that trip, and I think we were in China for maybe 2 weeks, every single night I had nightmares. And I would wake up screaming sometimes, just thinking about these dogs and hearing the dogs screaming, hearing my own dog, because I kept imagining and reliving in my nightmares this scene where my own dog is grabbed. And one of the reasons I'm pretty confident I actually saw it is because there are just little details about the slaughter of dogs that I feel like I wouldn't have even known as like an 8 or 9 year old kid unless I had seen it. So for example, the way they tend to grab the dogs is they have these massive tongs. They're like giant tongs that they use to grab the dog's neck and drag them to the place where they're going to be beaten to death. And I also remember hearing dogs screaming as they're being beaten. And I didn't even know at the time, but this is the way most dogs are killed for meat. You take a huge metal club and you smash their skulls repeatedly, and then you slit their throats and let them bleed out to die. And these are details I feel like I wouldn't know. It's also possible it's some sort of place memory. I mean, if you know about the research on memory, turns out that human beings are very good at inventing memories. So it's possible I learned these things later and projected back into the past, into my past. But whatever the exact cause of these nightmares was, whether it was a personal experience of actually seeing the dogs and hearing the dogs being killed, or just knowing that it was going to happen, it left me traumatized, not just for the couple of weeks I was in China, but for years thereafter. And I remember coming home and seeing my dog, and it was kind of a minor miracle. But that dog that I left behind in the United States, the dog that every vet told us had to die, we got back home, she started walking again. It was like, she was so happy to see us. She said, just screw this hip injury, whatever's going on with my legs, I'm just happy to see my brother Wayne. And she had lived another 9 happy years of her life. And partly because of that dog, some of my nightmares started going away. But like a lot of Americans, you know, you might hear something or see something bad happening to an animal, even a dog, and start wondering, what's going on? What is happening with the way we treat animals? But you don't recognize there's a bigger systemic problem. And I want to try and expand on my story and explain to you why I think it just factually is irrefutable that we're living in an era that can only be described as the greatest atrocity in human history. And the moment for me, unlike my experience of dogs, came from a book. I grew up still loving animals, but wondering about this experience I had in China, because we had seen not just dogs, but other animals. I remember we saw like this miserable, filthy zoo where there was a bear in a tiny cage. And, you know, in the United States, they like to put a nice cover on the zoo. They make it seem like it's beautiful and natural and the animals are happy, when in fact, both the process of holding these animals captive, capturing them in the wild, and then confining them in cages and in pens and in enclosures is awful for the animals. But in China, there are no illusions of humane care. The animals were all treated like crap. So I had these inklings that something was wrong in the way we treated animals, but it never occurred to me that there was something systematic happening that needed to be addressed. It never occurred to me that there was an atrocity unfolding in our country until I read a book with the title Animal Liberation. And even as someone who loved animals and cared a lot about animals, and you know, when I was growing up as a kid, not only did I love dogs, I loved the birds, I loved the bees, I talked to the squirrels outside my neighborhood, you know, my neighborhood yard. And, but I saw a book, and I think this was in my first year in college. It might've been my last year in high school, but I was about 16 at the time because I left high school a little early. And it had this title, Animal Liberation. And I just thought to myself, that's a weird title. I actually thought it was a fictional book. I thought it was like a, you know, a child's story, like Charlotte's Web, about animals freeing themselves and some sort of, you know, absurd childish fantasy. But then I look at the back, and it's by this Princeton philosopher named Peter Singer. It's a very reputable book and seems to have a very reputable author. And so I pick up the book and I open the first page, and the first page hits me like a truck. And I will remember that first sentence until the day that I die, because I read this sentence, and it's a sentence that in many ways changed my entire life. And the sentence is this: this is a book about the tyranny of human over non-human animals. Tyranny. And here I am, this, you know, dorky, very, very unconfident kid growing up in central Indiana, entirely white community, no friends, feeling very powerless, feeling totally socially inept. I don't feel like I've got anything going for me. And I read this book telling me that I'm part of a tyrant class. And tyranny is a very distinct form of politics. It is rule by fear. It is the idea that you have someone who's not just a monarch, not just a king, but a tyrant, someone who goes around terrifying everyone and imposing his will on them by fear. And the notion that I was part of a tyranny, because the book set out the argument for a tyranny of human over non-human animals, and I was a human animal for sure, and the notion that I was part of a tyrant class imposing my will by fear on a marginalized class, a powerless class of non-human beings, seemed absurd to me. So I put the book down and I almost didn't read it. I thought, is this a joke? This is like some parody of an actual book. Is this actually written by a real philosopher, a real thinker named Peter Singer? But I think I looked at the back of the cover, and there was no Google back then, so you could only read the inside and outside flap of the book cover. And it seemed like it was a reputable book, and I was fascinated by this idea. So I continued reading. And that's when I first learned about what can only be described as an atrocity. The book systematically goes through, case by case, all the different scenarios where animals are being used and abused by human beings for food, for fashion, for animal experiments in science, for entertainment. But also set out a concept that was a handful and a mouthful for me to even pronounce. And I think I didn't even know how to pronounce the word for maybe 3 years after I first read it. Maybe I still don't know how to pronounce it. But the word was speciesism. And what Singer does in this argument and in this book, which is still, in my view, the most compelling argument for animal rights that has ever been written, it sets out very carefully and logically that species membership is a form of discrimination that is as insidious and violent as racial discrimination, gender discrimination, or any other form of discrimination that human beings have fought and struggled against for the last few hundred years. And one of the most fascinating things is the initial anecdote from Animal Liberation, setting out the argument against speciesism, points out that there is a very prominent scholar in the 18th century, Jeremy Bentham, who once predicted that discrimination against women, against people of color, would be acknowledged as wrong and a form of discrimination. And he also points out that discrimination against animals will be seen the same way one day, that one day human beings will see discrimination against those who have four legs instead of two, or fur on their backs instead of bare skin, as the same as discrimination against people of color or against women. And Bentham and other people are making arguments of this sort. And in particular, there was a feminist scholar named Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote a book called The Vindication of the Rights of Women around the same time in the late 18th century. Were widely mocked. In fact, there was a Cambridge philosopher by the name of Thomas Taylor who, in response to some of these arguments, when he read A Vindication of the Rights of Women by Mary Wollstonecraft, he explicitly linked the rights of women to the rights of brutes. And he even wrote a parody. He wrote an entire book parodying and mocking the idea of women's rights by saying, if we give women rights, Because after all, we all know they're lesser creatures. They're smaller than us. They're weaker than us. They can't fight as well as we can. We can beat them up. We can imprison them and kill them and do all sorts of terrible things to them physically. So how could they possibly have equal rights? And if you're going to say they have equal rights, then what's another class of beings that are also smaller than us and weaker than us and not able to fight back effectively when we impose ourselves on them? Well, not even animals. So if you're going to give rights to women, you might as well give rights to brutes as well. And that analogy struck me as is pretty disturbing and compelling. Disturbing because it suggested that I was involved in a form of discrimination, not dissimilar to the forms of discrimination that were used against people like me, people of color. But insightful and interesting because the logic was very sound. Because when we think about what the basis of morality is, why do we think it's wrong to hurt someone? It's not because they're intelligent or powerful or wealthy. It's because they can suffer. And a woman who is smaller and weaker than a large man has a right not to be hurt, even though she has less power than him physically. And by that same logic, a non-human animal who has less power or wealth or even intelligence than a human animal has a right not to be abused by that human being. In fact, that's the basis of all morality. When you look at the last few centuries of moral progress, whether it's civil rights, rights for people of religious minorities, racial minorities, of various genders and orientations, so much of it is based on the idea that we are all entitled to dignity, that equality is our right. It is not something that must be given to us by the powerful, but is something that we always justly deserve, even if we did not have the power to fight for our rights. And Singer points to all the arguments that human beings often make to justify exploitation against animals. Well, they're less intelligent. Well, you know, there are a lot of disabled people who are less intelligent. Human infants are less intelligent. We now understand that the everyday chicken can pass the mirror test of self-awareness. A chicken can look at a mirror and realize, hey, that's me. A three-year-old child can't do that. A three-year-old child will look at a mirror and not even realize that that image is themselves rather than another human being or just a reflection and image that has nothing to do with them. We know that pigs play video games. And not only do they play video games, but when they're trained to play video games for treats and the treats are eventually taken away, they continue playing them for fun. That's something 3 and 4 year old children can't do. So if intelligence is a standard for moral status and suddenly we're excluding children, for example, from any moral status. We're excluding certain disabled people. One of the kids I was growing up with, his name was David, had a very serious disability and was basically always stuck at about the cognitive ability of, I'm guessing maybe a 4 or 5 year old. But he was one of the best people I'd ever met. He was kind to everyone. He never got angry. He never struck anyone. He was compassionate towards human beings and animals. And I would never have allowed anyone to hurt him just because he was less intelligent. For that same reason, I realized we cannot argue that animals are less intelligent and therefore we can hurt them. And then there's the argument the animals hurt each other, you know, which is honestly the same argument that white people used to target and imperialize people of color. They go into colonial territories in Africa or Asia and say, gosh, look at all these barbarians, they're all killing each other. So if we enslave and torture them, it's totally justified because after all, they're killing each other. And Singer points out this is a third grader's argument for morality, right? In third grade, in some cases, even third graders have evolved beyond this argument. In third grade, when someone hits you, you say, well, they're doing it too. And that's absurd. That's never been a good political moral argument for any sort of violence. Just because someone else is doing something, even if that someone else is in a different group, a different category, a different religion, or even a different species, doesn't mean you're entitled to do it. And of course, not even animals do all sorts of other things that we wouldn't say are justified just because they're doing them. So for example, lions will often kill the baby lions of a competing male lion. So when a male lion takes over a pride, he'll literally just slaughter all the infants in the pride when he takes over. We wouldn't say, oh, the animals are doing that, so I guess we can kill each other's children too. Of course not. That's absurd, right? And so Singer just, argument by argument, breaks down all the fallacies that justify the abuse of animals, and I felt like I had no arguments left. And by this point in my life, partly because I'd always been kind of an outsider, always been a dork, I'd always been kind of forced to fend for myself, sometimes physically, I was someone who prided myself in thinking differently and not accepting arguments just because everyone else believed in them. And I found myself thinking in roughly 1998 when I first read Animal Liberation was, I basically adopted this belief system, this ideology of human abuse of animals without thinking for myself. And the first moment I actually did think for myself, I could not come up with a single compelling argument to justify violence against animals. But again, beyond the moral argument was just seeing for the first time both the breadth and the severity of the suffering. And there's so many gruesome details that you learn about when you first hear about the violence against animals that's everywhere. But for me, you know, it came back to dogs. Like, I did not realize that this experience I had in China when I was a kid was not a unique and unusual experience. That even the animals we love most, even our best friends, are subjected to torture and abuse that is so bad, it's hard to even believe. So the United States, there are about 60,000 dogs used in experiments every year. These dogs live in cages virtually their entire lives. Cages that are so small they go psychotic and spin in a cage. And then the most common usage for these dogs within the context of scientific experiments is something called toxicology testing. And it started in the 1950s and 60s because we needed to test the toxicology of various forms of radiation and radioactive compounds like uranium. Because we had dropped two nuclear bombs in Japan, and a bunch of scientists realized, oh, we should probably figure out what all this radiation is going to do to the people in Japan, and even to our own soldiers, if we're going to drop bombs and continue to test nuclear weapons and even use nuclear power. And there's a problem with these radiation tests and these other forms of toxicology testing, where they're trying to test how much poison, how much radiation a living being can take, and that is that most living beings would just fight back or give up. They would stop trusting the experimenters, because after all, if you're being hauled in every day and poisoned to the point that your bones are breaking, and you know, these radiation experiments performed in beagles, by the end of the experiments, after a couple of years, I think the average beagle had dozens of bone fractures and could no longer walk because of all the tumors forming just in their bones. And that's just one part of their body that was falling apart because of all the toxins and radiation. But when animals are forced to endure this day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, it turns out most of them do one of two things. One is they just die. They starve to death. They give up because they say, this life is fucked. I'm done. The other thing that animals do if they don't give up is they fight back, right? They claw, they attack, they will not work with experiments. And it's very hard to subject an animal to experiments if they continue to fight. But what's different about dogs, because they've evolved and been selectively bred for 10,000 years to be our best friends through a process that's called neotenization. It's essentially breeding in an animal childlike characteristics, and that's exactly what we did to dogs. We took wild wolves that are very aggressive, sometimes brutal animals. We bred into them puppy-like characteristics, and that's what the modern dog is. An adult dog is essentially a wolf puppy. And because these animals are gentle and dependent and vulnerable and extremely loving and trusting of us, we could subject them to radiation toxicology experiments. It turned out we could radiate them day after day after day, week after week after week, month after month, and the dogs wouldn't give up or fight back because every day they'd come into the lab and hope, maybe this is the day that my masters will finally be kind. And when I read about this and saw some of the images, I just thought to myself, this can't be true. I mean, this is worse than what I saw in China, you know, when I was a kid. This is like something from a horror movie. But that sent me down the path, and I encourage you all to go down this path too, of reading and finding the evidence of what actually happens to animals, including dogs, in institutionalized animal exploitation as a result of this system of speciesism that we live in and that every human civilization that I'm aware of at least has lived in for the past 150,000 years of our history on this planet. It's a story that's very grim and gruesome, and showed me for the first time the shadow that hangs over our entire civilization. It's a shadow of violence that not many people see, but when you do see it, it shakes you and you realize we need change. Okay, so let me fast forward from that to the next experience, because I think a lot of people have some faint familiarity with institutionalized animal exploitation, the problem of speciesism, this idea that might makes right, or that because we're more intelligent or more advanced species were allowed to exploit and torture other living beings. But fewer people actually do something about it. And honestly, I was in that camp too. You know, for years after I first learned about what happens to animals, I didn't even go vegetarian. You know, I hadn't met a vegetarian until I went to college. I remember my grandmother literally telling me, if you go vegetarian, you're gonna die. Like, you will die. And that was the philosophy that a lot of Chinese immigrants had back then, because my parents and their parents were all very small and relatively weak, partly because they were malnourished. They grew up in a war-torn country, never had meat. And so I didn't make many changes. I thought, you know, how is it even possible to go vegetarian? Honestly, it didn't even occur to me yet. The book Animal Liberation suggested, but I had met a vegetarian. I didn't know how to eat vegetarian food. So I did nothing of the sort. But then my dog died. And I was still remember the day it happened, because I made a huge mistake. One of the biggest mistakes in my life. And this is a mistake I think all of us can learn from. And I hope I've learned from. And that is, I chose my career, my profession, and my personal advancement over being with the person I loved. So my mom called me a couple weeks before I was planning to take an examination called the GRE. It's an exam you have to take if you're applying for graduate school. And I was applying for a PhD program in economics. And said, there's something wrong. Vivian is having trouble walking, and she's had a number of seizures. And she's not eating very much. And I think you might need to come home and say goodbye. And I thought hard about it. This is the dog who meant more to me than anyone in my life, even my mom. I mean, my mom, rest in peace, Mom. I mean, I love her dearly, but this dog Vivian was my companion, my savior, my best friend. Every difficult experience, every joyous experience I had in my entire life, from that moment in China to coming home and seeing her miraculously recovered, to getting bullied by kids and beaten up and having my face sliced open. I mean, so many awful experiences, so many amazing experiences too. I'd lived with Vivian, and she had always been there to be with me and support me through it all. But I had the GRE, and I didn't know what to do. And when I talked to my parents about it, they actually, surprisingly to me, and they had changed a lot. They knew how important this dog was to me, and Vivian was important to them too, especially my mom. She loved my dog. She loved her dog dearly. So surprisingly to me, they said, you know, we understand you're taking this exam, but if you want to come home, you know, we can come pick you up. And we'll bring you home so you can see Vivian maybe for the last time. And I turned them down. I chose a stupid exam over being with the person I loved. And I think it was 2 days after I took the GRE or something like that. It might have been a week, might have been one day. Vivian died. And when she died, I had these really intense flashbacks to the experiences I had as a kid. I had this really intense sense of guilt and shame. I didn't go home after she died because I was so ashamed of myself for not going home. I didn't want to talk to my family. Every time I talked to my mom for, I think, months, maybe even years after that, I felt this deep sense of shame. But there was one good thing that came out of it all. And that one good thing was I decided I'm going to do something for her and for all the animals of this earth. And maybe you've had an experience like this too, that, you know, if you think, even just now, think for a moment about some animal who was important to you, what she meant to you. And I guess this is a part of the experience that most people don't have, but that I did have. I can imagine her being hurt, because I remember seeing that dog in China in a cage, cowering, scared, and about to die. And so I knew what was happening to dogs exactly like Vivian. And if you can imagine an animal you love who's meant something really important to you being hurt, not just hurt, but brutalized, imagine how you'd respond. And that's what I did on that day when I heard that Vivian died. I imagined her dying not peacefully with a family, but I imagined and remembered the dog who died very violently in China, and said to myself, I've done something wrong to her. I didn't kill her, and I didn't beat her to death, but I disrespected her memory, and I'm gonna do something about that. And that's the day I decided I'm going to be an animal activist. I didn't know exactly what that meant. I did immediately go vegan at that point because I'd been in college for a couple of years, and by that point in my life, I'd actually met some vegetarians and vegans. I thought they were all incredibly weird. But other than there's one extremely cute girl in a volunteer group who I liked a lot, and I tried going vegan for her, and she didn't care and didn't pay any attention to me. But I tried. But that was the day I decided I'm going vegan full stop, not turning back, and I've never intentionally had an animal product since then. You know, every now and then, everyone, or not everyone, somebody out there is probably perfect. I'm not, you know, I've bought the wrong product and had something that had some, you know, dairy flakes in it on accident, but certainly not intentionally. But more important than that, and this is kind of the key lesson of this channel, and the key lesson I want to impart to all of you is I decided I needed to take direct action. I needed to be a part of the movement for change instead of just being someone who's not part of the violence. I wanted to actively oppose the violence, and that's what I started doing in the year 2001 when my dog Vivian died. So the next stage of my life was this journey towards activism. And you know, how do you get from there to walk into slaughterhouses and taking animals out? Well, you get there very slowly for me. Because in 2001, when I started doing activism, I didn't know the first thing about activism. I never participated in really any meaningful form of protest. For me, the biggest challenge and the thing that seemed most courageous was just talking to people about what I knew, vegan outreach. And so starting roughly in the year 2001, and then all the way through, I think the year 2007, I started a campaign of leafleting. And one of the really fascinating things about this is you might think from listening to me today, if you've seen any other videos or presentations or speeches, that I had a natural gift for communication, natural confidence in public speaking. No. I was a embarrassing puddle of fear and shame every time I spoke to anyone, not even public speaking, just talking to people. I mean, I got all the way through college without even asking anyone on a date, without having any friends. I didn't go to a single party. I was so scared of talking to people. But my fear and social anxiety were overcome by my love for my dog. And so I decided I needed to start talking to people. And it just happened to be the case in the early 2000s, there was a number of great organizations, Vegan Outreach, PETA, that would send you these boxes of leaflets that you could then go out into the world and just hand them out and give them to as many people as you could and have as many conversations as you could. And I attribute a lot of my early activism to the fact that there were these great organizations that just supported the grassroots, that gave you free materials. There's also some pretty compelling research that came out around then suggesting that 2% of the people you give a leaflet to will go vegan, 2%. And when I saw this research, which I'll say more about this in a second, because really we should say research in quotes, because it wasn't the best research. But when I saw this research, I thought, this is just a numbers game. All I got to do is go hand out as many leaflets and we can change the entire world. Because after all, if 2% go vegan, then you take 50 years, you'll get 100%. So let's just go hand out leaflets. And that's what I did. Every single day, starting in roughly 2003 or four, when I was in law school, I would table or leaflet. I'd go to an extremely busy train station. I'd set up a table at the University of Chicago, where I was going to law school, and hand out vegan cookies and vegan leaflets and try and convince as many people as I could that what was happening to animals was wrong and they needed to step out of that system by going vegan or vegetarian themselves. And I was very happy about it. I was thinking to myself, wow, I'm doing such a great job. Because I think for those years, I was one of the top leafleters, maybe the number one leafleter in the nation, because I was doing it every day for a couple hours. I mean, tens of thousands of leaflets every year, tens of thousands of cookies baked over a 3-year period, because I got really efficient at baking like a couple hundred cookies in a batch, like very small cookies. They were tiny little chocolate chip cookies made with flaxseed and vegetable oil, because I couldn't pay for. And actually, even back then, I don't think there really was any vegan butter. It was all just vegetable oil. But I just handed out tons of leaflets, gave out tons of vegan cookies, and thought, the world's changing. I was feeling really good at myself. But something interesting happened, because at the same time I was doing all this vegan outreach, I was also studying social science and data science and trying to understand how we can prove various interventions actually make the world a better place, whether it's healthcare, global poverty, education, whatever it is. And when I looked more carefully at the study, I realized some of these studies that suggested that 2% of people would go vegan from giving them a leaflet, didn't even have a control variable. And they were entirely based on self-reports. In other words, they're giving people leaflets and they're just asking people, how many of you will go vegan? And 2% of people are saying, I will go vegan. And if you know anything about social scientific research, you know that doesn't work. For one, you know, it could be that 2% of people are already going vegan. And if you don't have a control variable, you can't compare the group that you gave a leaflet to the group that never got a leaflet at all. But secondly, there's something called social desirability bias, that when you ask someone a question and you know, and they know, what answer you want them to give, they tend to give you that answer, even if they don't mean it. You know, it's kind of like when someone asks you, how do I look today? How often do you actually give people a truthful answer? How often has someone asked you, how do I look? And your answer is, you look like shit. You're an ugly piece of shit, and that looks terrible. You don't say that. And similarly, when we ask people, are you going to go vegan? Nobody said, no, are you out of your mind? That's ridiculous. I love eating meat. No, people said what they wanted us to hear and then what they thought we wanted to hear, which is, yeah, thank you so much for the leaflet and the cookie. Of course I'm going to go vegan. But maybe the most disturbing thing for me is the personal data I was accumulating. Because again, as a social scientific student, I was, you know, doing a PhD in economics at the same time I was doing a law degree. I was collecting data. So every time someone committed to go vegan or vegetarian and asked them to give me their email, and I'd follow up with them, and I had this big ass mailing list of these vegans that I thought I'd created. And this list got bigger and bigger, and I sent out more and more emails. And I just consistently tried to check in on people and say, like, how's your veganism going? Like, you know, what are you eating this week? And did you hear about this new ice cream called Tofutti? Back in the day, there was no vegan ice cream. Tofutti was like the first brand that came out in the early 2000s, and everyone was going crazy. And I thought, all these new vegans, they're surely going to know about Tofutti cuties, right? And I found something both interesting and very depressing, which is no one seemed to respond. Like, I think of the hundreds and hundreds of emails I sent out, maybe thousands, I don't even remember, I can probably count on a couple of hands the number of times people actually responded. I mean, a lot of times these are even classmates, like people in, you know, at the University of Chicago who I knew, like I'd see the person and they wouldn't respond. And I thought to myself, if these people are actually vegan and I'm telling them about Tofutti ice cream, they're going to be all in. They're going to want to know. They're going to say, wait, where can I get this stuff? And it wasn't happening. And that was what set me down the path to direct action, because I realized that a lot of these impersonal forms of outreach, and there's a big social scientific literature on this, the term for it is impersonal outreach. And this is true of marketing campaigns for corporations. It's true of human rights campaigns. It's true of political campaigns and elections, and it's true of animal rights campaigns. Impersonal outreach is extraordinarily ineffective. It very rarely works. And I'm not saying you shouldn't try it, because I developed a lot of skills and confidence as an activist from talking to thousands of people. And there were people who went vegan. But the vast majority of time, it didn't work. And even the people who did go vegan, I found a lot of times it seemed like they were kind of on that path anyways. There are already people who are concerned about animals. And if it wasn't me, it would have been a documentary or a class or a connection at a party that would have caused them to go vegan. And also, a lot of the vegans I was able to confirm, and this is true even to this day, you know, we're now almost 20 years after I started that outreach experiment. A lot of the vegans who were going vegan, a year or two later, I'd find were no longer vegan. And the evidence shows that about 75% of people who go vegetarian or vegan give it up after 1 year. So after all these hundreds of thousands of leaflets given out, and these hundreds or maybe thousands of people have committed to go vegan, even among the people who had committed to go vegan, about 3 out of 4 were giving it up after 1 year. And so I asked myself, what am I doing wrong? And the answer, interestingly, came from the research I was doing. So I was part of a new breed of economics PhD students called behavioral economics students. And the idea behind behavioral economics is that human behavior is not fully rational, that people act pursuant to various biases and emotions, that they make poor probability calculations They think that, for example, the risk of terrorism is a lot higher than it actually is. This is actually an actual finding from social scientific research. Especially after 9/11, the World Trade Center attack, Americans would say there's like a 1 in 10 chance I'm going to die from terrorism, when it's like, you know, literally like 1 in 100 million, right? At least through American history, it's something like, maybe it's 1 in 10 million, 1 in 100 million. Very, very unlikely event. But one of the most important sources of bias is social norms, social networks, that human beings tend to do what other people do. And the problem with trying to convince all these people to go vegan, even in the face of these atrocities, even when I showed them these awful things that happened to animals, was even if one person's convinced, because human beings are not fully rational and independent, they do what other human beings do. When they go back into normal society, they will do what the other human beings do. And what the other human beings do is eat animals and say that's fine, or not even think about whether eating animals is fine. It's part of the social normative structure of human civilization. And so I'm looking at this research showing that human beings are boundedly rational. They're not fully rational. I'm looking at the research showing that social networks are often more important than individual persuasion in creating genuinely systemic change. And I come across a paper by a very prominent sociologist who has, I think it's the second most cited paper in the history of sociology and one of the most cited papers in the history of social science. And it's got quite the name, and it was published in Nature, a journal that's normally about biological systems, but one of the most prominent peer-reviewed publications in the sciences. And the name of the paper is Collective Dynamics of Small World Networks. Collective Dynamics of Small World Networks. You probably never heard of this paper. You should, though. If you care about changing the world, you should hear about this paper. But the basic proposition of the paper, which has now been established by another 20 years of research. It was published in 1998 in Nature magazine. It's been cited over 55,000 times. And it's had impacts in everything from economics to sociology to biology to physics to artificial intelligence research. But there are a couple basic ideas in this paper that shook me up and made me realize I needed to think bigger. I needed to think systemic in my activism if I really wanted to help animals. The first proposition is that human society is a small world. And what I mean by that is, no matter how many human beings are on this planet, whether we have 6 million, 600 million, or 6 billion, every human being is connected to every other human being by about 6 levels of connection. Let me say it again. Every human being is connected to every other human being by 6 levels of connection. And this is honestly kind of wild, because you'd think as the human population gets bigger, how is it possible we're all still so closely connected to each other? And the reason is human social networks are small world networks. No matter how big they get, they stay very small in the sense that connection, influence, ideas, fashion can jump from one place in the world to the flat out the other side of the world completely in just 6 jumps. So the second proposition of this paper, though, was even more interesting, which is how did it become a small world network? How is it possible that whether we have 60 people, 6 million, 6 billion, or 600 billion, we still have this small world network phenomenon? And what Watts and his co-author Strogatz found, and I did a podcast with Duncan Watts, which you shouldn't listen to because it's a completely embarrassing podcast where I am just fanboying over him the entire podcast. I kid you not, when I started listening to this podcast, I had to shut it down within 10 seconds because I was so embarrassed by how much I was fanboying, because I was so happy to see and talk to Duncan Watts for the first time. Which no one knows about him, but he's the most influential figure, or not the most influential, among the most influential figures in the social sciences. What Watts and Strogatz found was, it was not the quality of the connection or the nature of the individuals in the network that drove the small world phenomenon. It was the structure of the network. And particularly when you combine two things, close clustering of human beings who are local to each other. So, and this is the way human beings operate. We tend to operate in cliques. We're very close to a small number of people, and then we don't know everyone else. Anyone who lives in a big city has experienced this phenomenon of, you know, living in a huge city and knowing nobody, but you're 15 or 20 friends, right? We've all had that experience probably. But that's combined with randomization. So human beings tend to be very cliquish. We cluster with a small group of human beings. But every now and then, maybe one in 1,000 human beings is just randomly connected to another human being, maybe even across the entire face of the planet. And we combine those two attributes in a social network, that creates a small world. It creates a network where things can be connected from one side of the planet to the next with extreme efficiency. You might be asking, what the heck does it do with activism? Well, it taught me two things. One is it taught me that change can happen incredibly quickly because even in a very big world with 6, 7, 8 billion people, if we're all connected by 6 jumps, that means change can happen throughout the entire planet with incredible rapidity. But the other thing it taught me is that the structure of the network that many people can't even see is often very important in that change. Because the reason the small world network exists is because of a relatively insignificant, at least from a local perspective, you're just one of these human beings in a city of, you know, a million, like the city I live in, San Francisco. You might not even realize if there's a small change in the network structure, in the nature of the social relationships of the people in San Francisco. That small change in relationships between people in San Francisco and, say, people in Beijing or Shanghai or Timbuktu or whatever city it is can make a dramatic difference in how quickly your change spreads across nations, within a city, or even within an organization. That there's something about network structure that was often invisible to the people within the network that can make a huge difference in how quickly change happened. And so naturally, I want to understand this more. So I dug a little deeper into this and asked myself, okay, what's going on? I mean, what can we learn about social networks and sociology and change through human civilization over the last 10,000 or even 150,000 years? And what I found over and over again is that when it comes to social change, nonviolent direct action was the tried and true mechanism through which change would spread through a social network, right? And why is that the case? When you have a small world network, change can happen very quickly, but it needs to be amplified, right? It has to get to the point where it hits a critical threshold where people don't even know about the change you're asking for the world to undertake. And the power of nonviolent direct action is that it's change that, because it's direct action, you know, you're doing something disruptive, you're doing something that's counter-normative, it gets a lot of attention. But because it's nonviolent, it can spread through the network very quickly because more people are willing to take on the task of doing the direct action themselves, right? The direct action seizes a narrative because it's exciting and dramatic, but then it spreads quickly and gets more people on board because it's nonviolent. So you maintain the moral high ground. And the lesson from sociological and political science research is that when grandmothers and grandchildren can participate in the activism, that's when it can scale up and spread through a social network like wildfire. And so that's what I decided roughly in 2007, 2008 that I needed to be a part of. And that brings me to the stories that I told you at the start of this conversation, the rescues. Because the most powerful form of nonviolent direct action the animal rights movement has ever seen over the last 40 years since this movement became a real movement in 1975 when Peter Singer wrote the book Animal Liberation and Ingrid Newkirk shortly thereafter founded the organization People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. But the most powerful form of nonviolent direct action this movement has ever seen is rescue. Going back to the 1980s when PETA got its start, a woman in named Valerie, or that's her pseudonym, who was a police officer at the time, saw some primates being tortured, seized by the police, and saw those primates, by court order, were gonna go back to the vivisector who had tortured them, and decided to take direct action and just rescue those animals, and that's what she did. She took those animals out of the place where they had been seized and prevented them from going back to the lab. Jean Bauer, the founder of Farm Sanctuary, was with his wife at the time, Lori, and they saw a lamb at a stockyard in Pennsylvania. And she was collapsed in a dead pile. She lifted her head up. She was clearly suffering. And they decided to walk right onto that property and take her home. And that was the beginning of Farm Sanctuary and the farm animal movement in the 1980s. And then maybe most powerfully, because the rescue that Valerie did in the book Free the Animals by Ingrid Newkirk, which I highly encourage everyone to read because it's an amazing book, just a dramatic story. The rescue that Jean and Lori did in the 1980s at a stockyard in Pennsylvania. Neither of these really seized the power of rescue the way it's been seized today. But that power is finally realized in the early 1990s by an otherwise unassuming woman by the name of Patty Mark in Australia. She's actually an American, but she moved to Australia and heard for the first time that little birds are being tortured in cages. They're literally collapsed in the feces underneath the cage, rotting to death inside their cages because they're pecked to the point they have no feathers and are being cannibalized. When she heard this and walked in and saw with her own eyes, this is truly happening. This is not a nightmare. This is real. She decided, not only do I need to help these animals, but I need to show the entire world that I'm helping them so we can inspire other people and eventually our entire society to help them too. And that was the start of the Open Rescue Movement. And I think the year was 1992. I could be off by a year or so. Patty Mark did this. She got national media attention in Australia and triggered a movement for farm animals that has spread now across the globe. But what's my piece and what's your piece? What we've seen is Open Rescue has been an extraordinarily powerful tactic, both to expose the abuse that happens to animals and inspire people to support the animal rights movement. Because when you see an animal taken from the brink of death and brought back to life, you want to help. You want to be a part of that. It's the most powerful tactic of the movement. It is the embodiment of what all of us believe. It's what we dream of. It's what everybody dreams of. When they see an animal suffering, they want them to be helped. We're bringing that dream to light. What's happened over the last 15 to 20 years, however, since Patty brought this tactic and strategy to the United States in the early 2000s, is enormous amount of industry and legal repression. Starting in the year, I believe, 2006, when my friend Adam Duran was convicted and incarcerated for merely taking some sick animals from an egg farm to the vet. Sentenced to 6 months, and only served 1 month because of various procedural defects in his case. There's been a massive effort to clamp down on this movement of rescue that spread across the globe and crush it, precisely because the industry and its government allies understand how effective this tactic and strategy is. And so when I first became exposed to Open Rescue, I was first excited to not necessarily even be involved, because back in the early 2000s, again, I was a graduate student who was an egghead. I didn't think I was someone who'd be scampering around in the middle of the night in factory farms. But I thought, maybe I can at least be friends with the people who do this. When the people started going to jail for this, I and everyone else got scared. And so the movement collapsed. And Open Rescue, for the most part, in the United States disappeared after Adam Duran was convicted in 2006. But at the same time that Adam Duran was sitting in a jail cell, and my friends Lauren Gazzola and some others, Josh Schwartz, were incarcerated for similar activities they took in regard to a vivisection facility called Huntington Life Sciences. I thought back to what I had read in the history books in elementary school, middle school, even in college, about the letter from a Birmingham jail, about the trial of Susan B. Anthony, about the efforts made by anti-slavery activists, many of whom were beaten and killed, not just jailed, for their efforts to try and free slaves as part of the Underground Railroad. And I thought, wait a minute. If we stop doing this just because it's effective, then how are we going to create change? And if other movements also faced not just jailing and incarceration, but literally being murdered and killed as civil rights activists, as women's rights activists, as anti-slavery activists faced over the last 200 years, then surely we can learn to respond to this repression as well. And who better to learn from that than someone who's a lawyer and law professor, someone who's literally studying the sociology, the economics, the network science of change. So that's precisely what I did. And what you find when you start looking both at the history books and the research on civil resistance, and this is the terminology that's often used in social science, nonviolent direct action is more or less equivalent to civil resistance, is an incredibly powerful body of literature and evidence showing that when you mobilize 3.5% of the population in sustained nonviolent direct action, you almost always win. In fact, initially the hypothesis was that you always win, because the first few hundred case studies that social scientists looked at, they found that every single one that reached 3.5% won. Now I think there's one they've found. Erica Chenoweth, a scholar at Harvard, has found a single example of a movement that reached that critical threshold and did not win. But one of the ways they won in the face of repression, and one of the ways they kept growing to the point where they hit that critical threshold. And for the record, 3.5% was the maximum threshold that was required. Many movements won with 1% or even 0.1%, or sometimes even less than 0.1% of the population. What was crucial in all these campaigns was a commitment to nonviolence. Because when the state represses you, when you're thrown in jail, if you have compassion in your heart, if it's clear to the entire population that what you did was not morally or legally wrong, and yet you're still sitting in a jail still suffering, the very repression that scared the movement for animals in the mid-2000s can become something that inspires the movement in the 2010s and 2015s and 2020s. So this is a theory. It hadn't been tested. But in 2012, I and a number of activists, including Priya Sahani, Ronnie Rose, who's going to be in one of the first podcasts. Well, not Priya, because I can't talk to Priya. I've been forbidden from contacting Priya as part of my probation in Sonoma County. But Ronnie and I had a conversation that you're going to hear about very shortly about how we needed to try and bring this tactic of nonviolent rescue, of nonviolent direct action, of civil resistance to the animal rights movement. And that's what started an organization called Direct Action Everywhere. We wanted to bring direct action everywhere. Everywhere animals are suffering, everywhere you place them in cages and chains, everywhere you threaten their families and you slaughter them, we will be there and we will rescue. And that was our mission. That was our theory. It's a mission that has now been realized far beyond my wildest dreams. Because when we started that in 2012 and 2013, a band of activists of no money, no reputation, no notoriety, no organizing structure, rescuing one bird by the name of May. And you're going to hear more about the rescue in our first conversation with Ronnie. We went from there to inspiring thousands of people across the globe to participate in nonviolent direct action. Hundreds of people to join us in rescuing animals. And there now have been hundreds of animals rescued by the Open Rescue Network that we developed. And in a single action, 500 people walking with us in broad daylight after calling the police ourselves to rescue animals from a factory farm in Sonoma County. And maybe even more importantly, taking the prosecutions, the efforts by the industry to crush us and throw us in jail and separate us from our families and our friends, in an act of moral jujitsu, turning that back on the industry by using the very avenues through which they try to repress us to create even more change. And this is a theory behind the right to rescue. If we believe that animals are living beings who deserve rights, if they are persons and not property, living beings with cognizable legal interests, then we simply need to act as if they are as such. We have to take direct action. We have to be the change we want to see in the law. We have to be the change we want to see in the world. And we believe that when the government attacks us for trying to be that change, for acting as if animals have legal rights, and when our actions are scrutinized by a jury of our peers in a criminal trial, they will stand for animal rights and not for those who abuse them. So this is a theory. It was a theory that would allow us to create a snowball effect too, because if we were able to rescue animals, win these historic victories in court, we could inspire more people to participate, have even bigger actions, and have more court cases and more victories, and create a massive snowball effect for change that would end with the liberation of all sentient beings. But it was just a theory until recently, because we did the rescues. We rescued May from a factory farm in Sonoma County. I rescued a piglet named Lily, who was collapsed and starving to death on the floor of the largest factory farm for pigs in the entire nation in southern Utah. And as we expected, the government came after us, just like they came after Adam Duran in 2006. And we went to trial. And 10 years before I personally expected to win in rural agricultural Utah, we won a historic verdict after the FBI, the most powerful corporations in the world, including the CEO of Costco and Smithfield, the largest pork production company in the world, the Attorney General of the state of Utah, the highest elected legal officer in the entire state, an incredibly powerful man. In the face of all those forces trying to put me in prison for 60 years, we won in a court of law. Because the people of Utah, even in an agricultural, conservative, Trump-supporting county in Utah, the people of this country wanted to rescue animals and not to torture them. And I guess this is what this channel is about. It's about how we won that trial. It's about how we tell that story, how we cultivate more rescuers and lawyers and trials and acquittals and convictions too, and how we respond to those convictions. But maybe most importantly, what this channel is about you. I want to hear from people like you. I want to engage with people like you and learn about your dreams, about your nightmares, about the opportunities you have, that I have in working with you to seize the moment, to end this atrocity, cast light on the darkest shadow on human civilization, and liberate every sentient being on this planet from their cage. So you're going to hear from influencers like James Aspie. You're going to hear from legendary figures in the movement like Peter Singer. You're going to hear from grassroots activists who you probably don't know, like Ronnie Rose. And in these stories, I'm confident you're going to find your path to not just being a part of this movement, but helping us create systemic change. And if you do listen and you do engage and follow the Substack and the YouTube channel and leave a comment and ask a question and maybe even appear on the show, come to a training, because we're going to start doing trainings all over the country as well, so we can mobilize more people to rescue the animals from these dark and vile places. I think you'll find not only that you're empowered as an activist, but you're empowered as a human being. Because there's one thing above all else that allows a human being on this planet to realize their true potential, and that is purpose. And I can think of no greater purpose in life than to save billions of animals from a cage and from a blade. Just go do it. So folks, if you do want to be a part of this, first, make sure you click on the link in the description and learn about our roadmap to constitutional rights for animals, how we can win the right to rescue for animals across this country. But second, make sure you hit that subscribe button, because we're going to start releasing videos on Tuesday and Friday of every week, just little conversations of me and other animal rights activists and people beyond the animal rights movement. And if you want to be involved, if you want to learn the things that I've learned and learn from all the incredible people I'm going to be talking to, you're going to want to subscribe. So make sure you hit that subscribe button. Make sure you follow the roadmap. And I will see you all in the weeks and months to come, because I'm going to go on a listening tour, and I'd love to hear from you.